Next case this morning is 23-1213, Estate of Allier v. Wahira. Counsel for appellant, if you'd make your appearance and proceed, please.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Sullivan Mannion, and I represent the estate of Steve Allier and his wife, Arlinda Allier. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about the dismissal of plaintiff's complaint for a 12B6 motion for failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. The court, in dismissing that case, relied heavily on finding that the defendants were entitled to qualified immunity. The court based that conclusion on the two-step analysis that's found in LIHOC, that being whether the plaintiff's met its burden in establishing sufficient facts that would show that defendants violated a right, and whether that right was clearly established at the time. The court assumed, for its reason, that the first step had been met, and so therefore I'm going to focus on the second step. But before I do so, I would like to highlight that when reviewing a motion to dismiss based upon qualified immunity, the court should not dismiss a case unless it appears beyond a doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts that would entitle them to relief, beyond a doubt. Now, when we look at the clearly established law, we need to find Supreme Court, Tenth Circuit, or other circuit authority that would establish that a reasonable official would understand that the actions they took violated that right. We believe we do so in both cases in Allen and Savalos. The defendants would like to believe that Allen would like to argue that Allen stands for the position that in order to overcome qualified immunity, that you need to assert that an officer took some overt action that aggravated or precipitated the need to use deadly force. However, that's not what Allen stood for. This court in Allen analyzed that there was a material dispute of fact, a genuine issue of fact. And that dispute was the way in which the officers approached Allen when he was in his car. Mr. Allen was sitting in his car outside of his sister's house, and there's conflicting testimony as to whether officers ran up screaming at Mr. Allen, or rather, they came up calmly. The court found that, based upon those facts, it could find that a jury would rule in favor, or establish a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs, that under a 12B6 motion, all the facts are taken in light most favorable to the plaintiff, and therefore those disputes of fact were established in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. That meaning that the officers ran up and confronted Allen while he was sitting in his car.
Did they not use the term that the officers escalated the situation in that?
They did, Your Honor, and that was in that case that the officers escalated. But the real issue was, what was the fact? There's conflicting testimony about what happened. And in that case, it was the issue of what the officers did. However, there's multiple other cases, including Savalos and Sevier, which Savalos relied upon, where it was the actions of the plaintiff that were, or not the plaintiff, but the victim, essentially, that what did they do immediately prior to being shot and immediately prior to that excessive lethal force. In Savalos, there was the question of whether Mr. Savalos approached the officers quickly or if he was slowly.
Let me ask you a question about your complaint and then another question about your reliance on these two cases. Your complaint described the replica that was at play here and the fact that traditionally they have orange tips on there. I don't recall an averment in the complaint where you said this replica had an orange tip.
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't have facts to establish that that actually occurred. The discovery is limited as we are in the motion to dismiss stage, so we did not have that fact to base our...
Okay, so you don't know whether the purported gun in this case had an orange tip on it or not.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, okay, we do establish that upon Mr. Allier throwing that gun down, the barrel broke off.
Okay.
That should have been clear indication that this was a pellet gun.
Okay. It was the barrel that broke off.
It was the barrel that broke off.
And the second question is, I want to be clear What is it that you're relying on Allen and Sabalos for? I mean, what is the through line that you deem to be pertinent to establishment of clearly established law in this case? What about those two cases?
I think first you have to look at the mental state of the victim. In Allen, it was suicidal ideation. In Sabalos, it was an individual who I believe was under some kind of drugs, that his friends were saying that maybe he was on drugs. That altered mental state, in combination with the circumstances in those cases, it was unreasonable for the officers to use excessive force without doing something more, without investigating more, without using alternative tactics, because of the situation in which you could clearly tell these individuals were under an altered mental state.
And did you plead here that the officers were aware that this decedent was aware of, had an altered mental state?
Yes, Your Honor. We allege that first that the officers knew of this individual, or at least he was known to the community for having some behavior problems. He also, during this altercation, admits that he's threatening suicide, that he's feeling suicidal. And so I think both of those things in conjunction raise that mental state even higher than it was in Sabalos or in Allen, where essentially there's an individual where there's just one phone call.
But as I read, and maybe I'm mistaken, but the officers in your case, they kind of formed a perimeter but never took another action, aggressive or anything, toward the decedent. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I would argue that we don't allege that they took any further step in terms of progressing towards Mr. O'Lear. However, we do allege that they took actions which aggravated and precipitated the use of deadly force. That being calling Mr. O'Lear out of his house after the situation had already dissipated. Whatever the situation was, when the officers arrived at the scene, Mr. O'Lear was back in his house, and the individuals that reported this were no longer there. They called him out and asked him to then turn over his weapon. He throws the weapon at the officers in hopes that they would bring him and pick it up, okay? Then he goes back inside under this altered mental state. The officers call him back out. They continue to call him back out without going, picking up the gun, without establishing a closer perimeter, trying to retrieve this airsoft replica, and instead continue to aggravate these circumstances until the point when they made the premeditated decision that if he were to go and try to touch the gun again, that they would then fire.
Okay, so the aggravation of the situation, precipitation of the need to use deadly force, is the other through line that you see of Allen and Sabalos. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so mental state, aggravation, is there anything else in those two cases that you draw on?
The totality of the circumstances, I think we can look at both the Graham factors and Larson factors, but I think what we can really look at is, too, what was the weapon? In this case, it was an airsoft replica. It was not as lethal as the case of Allen, where he was holding a handgun. It was maybe potentially more lethal than a bat, I would say, but from 187 feet away, there was hardly any doubt that he was going to use the airsoft replica as any sort of weapon outside of what it could do to shoot the pellets.
And was it more lethal than the bat in the sense that the barrel broke off?
I would argue that if anything, it would be more lethal to Mr. Lear if it were to misfire than to any of the officers. And on that point, there was no immediate threat to any of the officers or to the public at large. And that's based upon our genuine issue of material fact. That being, what exactly happened immediately prior to Mr. O'Lear being shot and killed? Was he picking up the gun? Did he go grab the gun? Did he aim the gun at the officers at all? We have conflicting testimony. We have officers who state that on that final approach, he picked up the gun and aimed it at them. We have other officers that say during the entire encounter, Mr. O'Lear did not pick up the gun and aim it at them. However, when we are reviewing this case, under the motion to dismiss standard, we have to take those factual disputes in the favor of the plaintiff.
Well, what does that mean? And that see, this whole conversation about discrepancies in the what the officers say really, it seems to me, is irrelevant. The point is, we're taking your universe of facts based upon the pleadings. And so, taking your view of what the world is, what can one reasonably read your complaint as saying happened? Did he pick up the gun? Did he not pick up the gun? What is the view?
The view is that he either didn't pick up the gun in that final approach, or that he also and or never aimed that airsoft replica at any of the officers. And I believe
for clearly established law, you're relying on Allen and Ceballos. Anything else? Are there any other comparable cases you're relying upon?
Your Honor, I would also point you to Sevier, which was part of the discussion in Ceballos, was the Sevier case, which was not a published opinion based upon these grounds, but had similar facts, in which Sevier was, he was essentially, he had a knife, but there was this determination that, okay, there's a disputed material fact as to if he had the knife, if he came at the officers, and that, again, that disputed material fact was weighed in his favor, and therefore the officers acted recklessly in not assessing the situation with an individual who had a mental health crisis, who may or may not have approached him with a knife, and therefore that was something to take into consideration under the totality of the circumstances. And so Sevier is maybe a more analogous case. I would say Ceballos and Sevier are the most analogous cases in terms of the victim's conduct being at issue of what exactly occurred immediately prior to the shooting. However, even if we concede the fact that this Allen case requires us to establish that there is some aggravation, as I discussed earlier, we believe that we alleged that he was coaxed out of his house, that he tried to comply, and that he was shot without any other regard, without investigating into the case any further. We also believe that the district court erred in dismissing the state law claims summarily, without addressing them whatsoever.
Didn't you also have a claim, a failure to protect claim separate from the excessive force claim?
That we had a failure to treat, yes. That is correct, Your Honor. And that claim was based on essentially their care. They failed to provide any care for Mr. O'Leary.
What was your best case to support that claim? What is your best case?
Well, Your Honor, to be quite honest, I didn't even necessarily look at that because we were trying to overcome the establishment of qualified immunity and to try to get into the Fourth Amendment excessive force case. And so under that second action, I don't have any case law to bring to you other than what's in our brief and what's in our
All right. Let's move to the – oh, go ahead.
No, please.
On the municipal liability claims, what are you relying on in your complaint for policy or custom?
Your Honor, we established that there are staggering statistics that – the county, Mesa County, had a 5 times higher rate of these types of shootings in which an individual under some kind of altered mental capacity had been shot and killed. We believe that that statistic alone brings into question whether there should be a policy on how to evaluate these types of cases. When you arrive to the scene, you have an individual.
Have we ever held that statistics alone will establish a claim?
No, Your Honor, but we believe that the statistics combined with the facts of this case and the fact that we can't find any established policy, that the fact that there is no established policy is a policy in itself, a policy of indifference. And by not creating a policy, you're enacting a policy by doing nothing.
Well, Grand Junction is not coterminous with Mesa County, right?
That is correct.
So those statistics aren't even entirely directed at Grand Junction.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so why isn't that relevant to the question of, you're saying give this should have told them a Grand Junction that they should have a policy. Well, there are other parts of Mesa County where they're engaged in this activity. Why would that necessarily be probative to them?
Well, Your Honor, I would essentially argue that it's top-down, that you have to have the county addressing these issues to all the other police departments within the county, and that, therefore, they lacked and they did not take their affirmative step to enact policy.
Oh, the county should have had the policy.
The county should have had policy, correct.
Okay, and isn't there, What do you do with the argument that that a lawsuit against the county is not appropriate anyway, that it should have been a lawsuit against the Board of County Commissioners?
Your Honor, I agree with that. And so I believe that the only real argument that I can state here is that we plausibly stated the claim, just however it was against the wrong party. And if you were able to amend that complaint, that's a simple cross out and write in. And I see that I'm out of time.
Okay. We'll give you a little bit of rebuttal. Unless there are any questions. Okay.
Thank you.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Eric Zaporin. I am here on behalf of defendants appellees Thomas Nelson, Thomas O'Hara, and the City of Grand Junction. Those have been referred in the briefing as the Grand Junction defendants. There are also the Mesa County defendants involved in the case, and seated at council table is Christopher Brophy. He will be addressing arguments on behalf of Mesa County. We would respectfully ask that the time be split here, 50-50, so absent any questions or and with the permission of the court, at that midway point, I will sit down and defer the rest of my time to Mr. Brophy.
You're going to need to be watching that clock, okay?
I will do my best.
Okay. Well, let me start by, as it relates to clearly established law, we had a 2010 decision called Zia Trust Company XRL Causey versus Montoya. And in that case, where we cited another case, we said, quote, we do not think it requires a court decision with identical facts to establish clearly that it is unreasonable to use deadly force when the force is totally unnecessary to restrain a suspect or to protect officers, the public, or the suspect himself. My question to you is, why isn't that this case? He has pled that the barrel on the gun was not on the gun. Under the best version of the complaint, either he did not have the gun, what the stock of the gun in his hand, or he was not pointing it at anyone. In that situation, and he was a distance from the officers. Why do you need more to know you cannot shoot him?
Well, I think it's important, Your Honor, to look at both what is pled and what is not pled in the First Amendment complaint. And I agree with Your Honor's question earlier. We are limited to that only which is in the First Amendment complaint.
And everything I just said is in the First Amendment complaint. And so why could they shoot him?
And I would respectfully disagree as to one fact that you referenced, Ron.
Which is?
Nowhere in the First Amendment complaint is there the allegation that Mr. O'Leary was not touching the gun or grabbing the gun at the time he was shot. What is alleged to be inconsistent is whether or not he was pointing the gun, and there's an allegation that he was never pointing the gun, but there is not an allegation anywhere in that First Amendment complaint that he was never at any point touching the gun at the moment he was shot.
What about the officer saying, if he grabs the gun, I will shoot him? Isn't an inference from that he wasn't grabbing the gun at all?
And that is what is in the complaint, but reading that in context, it's what the officer is saying, if he grabs the gun before he grabs the gun, then I'm going to shoot him. There is no comment from that particular officer. There is no allegation in the complaint that officer said he never grabbed the gun.
Well, we're construing the facts in light most favorable to the plaintiff, and it says if he does something, infers the inferences he hadn't done it yet, right?
Well, we also have officers, an allegation that multiple officers stated in their interviews following the event that Mr. O'Leary grabbed the gun immediately prior to him being shot. That's in the complaint as well.
Okay,
so let's accept that fact as well.
Well, let's back up then. If for a moment we adopt the view that he had the gun, it seems to me that construing the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, he did not point it at anyone. And he did not point it at anyone, and the barrel was off the gun.
There is no allegation in the complaint. You asked about the orange muzzle. There's no allegation in the complaint officer saw an orange muzzle that would identify it as a replica. There is no allegation in the complaint that the officers from 187 feet away saw the muzzle break off of the weapon. And more importantly to your question, Your Honor, there is no constitutional requirement that police officers wait for a gun to be pointed at them before they're allowed to use lethal force. As the court stated in the state of Larson versus Muir, officers do not have to wait for the glint of steel because by that point in time, it's often too late for them to protect themselves, which is why we submitted as our supplemental authority the estate of Alan George versus City of Rifle case.
Well, in Thompson versus Salt Lake County, I believe that case is, a lot of effort was spent on the whole question of whether he had lifted the gun up to point it at the officers. It seems to me it's relevant in this case to know whether he in fact had done anything with that gun. If he hadn't, if he just had a gun, and let's assume it didn't, well, as we clarified, it didn't, we don't know whether it had an orange tip or not, and that's not pled. But the point is, if he picks up the gun, note, a third time, the first two times that he picked up the gun, he pushed it away from himself, right, towards the officers. Well, why would it be a natural inference for the officers to believe he would do anything other than that this time?
Because the totality of the circumstances here, when they arrive on scene with a significant police force and they loudspeaker him out of the home, what is the very first thing that Mr. O'Leary does when he exits that home? He brings a gun. He eventually then goes back inside. He drops the gun. He eventually goes back inside. On multiple occasions, what does he do each time he comes out of that home? He goes towards that weapon.
And the weapon that he had pushed away from himself the first time, right?
Correct.
Okay, so he pushed it away from himself the first time. Second time, he does likewise, right?
I believe the allegations are either in one occasion he throws it, another occasion he kicks it.
Okay, each occasion pushing it away from himself instead of using it. Instead of lifting it up and instead of pointing it, he pushes it away from himself. So he comes out a third time. Why is it natural inference to believe that he's doing anything other than what he did the first two times?
Because if his true intent was to not use the weapon, then the easiest tell for those officers are for him to not even go near that weapon in the first place. Every time he goes close to that weapon and repeatedly keeps going towards the weapon, the threat for them increases. His idea that there was no threat, that the threat had dissipated because he was in his home and the boys that were playing basketball had run away, this was a significant threat to these officers.
Yes, and to be clear, I'm not focusing on the boys running away. I'm focusing on what threat they had in that moment in time when they shot him. And if the first two times he pushed the weapon away, if he was going to do something, why didn't he do it then?
Because he chose, for whatever reason he chose not to, and for whatever reason the officers used restraint those first two occasions to not use lethal force. But every time he keeps going back to that weapon, under the state of Larson versus Muir, the fourth factor, this manifest intentions of the subject, it was reasonable for them to assume each time he keeps going for that. And on this occasion, we have an allegation. One of the officers says he reached and bent down and grabbed the gun.
Well, okay. Well, wait a minute. Okay. Well, for the moment, I'm not contesting whether he had the gun in his hand or not. What I'm saying though is under the best, at a minimum, under the best case scenario in the complaint, he didn't point the gun at anybody. And you say manifest intent. Well, you got two times where he had an intent to push the gun away from him. And so the question is, what's the intent the third time? Let me ask you this question. Would it be your view that when he walked out the first time and had that gun, the officers had a right to shoot him then?
They could have, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if he hadn't pointed the gun at them, walked out of his house with the gun, they could have shot it.
Yes, there is no, and it's not been cited to by the plaintiff. There is no constitutional requirement. In fact, it's the opposite.
There's a constitutional right that you, the requirement that you face a threat to you or a threat to the public. If somebody walks out with their gun like this across their chest and walks out of their home, you mean to tell me you can shoot him dead right then?
I would think, based on the totality of the circumstances, Your Honor, this is somebody who has brandished a knife at boys playing basketball. This is somebody who has already pointed a rifle at these boys who are playing basketball and has now secreted himself inside his home, is told to come out of his home, and what does he do? He comes out with a rifle. At that point, there is no case that I am aware of that would have required the officers to sit back and wait for Mr. O'Leary to point that rifle at one of them before they could use lethal force.
There are cases that require you, and the constitutional right requires you to have as pointed out in this case that I just read to you, there has to be some notion that it was necessary to protect yourself. A reasonable officer would believe that. You're distance away from him. There are multiple officers there. He, under my hypothetical, he comes out, which is actually a better one for you than what turned out to be the fact, which was that he threw the gun towards you. Well, under my hypothetical, he comes out with the gun across his chest. At that moment in time, what reasonable officer believes their life is in danger?
Well, there is a risk of serious physical harm or their life would be in danger. Because in a moment's notice, based on the history they have with this particular man, that gun could be pointed and turned upon any of them in a moment's notice. And that's why we provide the supplemental authority of the City of Rifle case, because the Tenth Circuit very much addressed that issue, this issue of a hostile motion. They're not required to wait for a gun to be pointed at them before they can protect themselves. They get to go home that night.
Well, what's the hostile motion when he pushes the gun away from them two times, and the third time, at a minimum, construing the facts in light most favorable to the plaintiff, he grabs the gun but doesn't pull it up. And I want to be cognizant of your time too, so you tell me when you want to sit down.
Let me answer the question and then I'll sit down with the permission of the court.
Yes.
Every time, and I've already said it, so I apologize that I'm repeating myself. The threat here is enhanced each and every single time that Mr. Allaire decides to approach that weapon. If his intentions truly were not to use it, why go near it? And in the very moment that he shot, as alleged in the complaint, he bends down and he grabs that gun. And at that very moment, these officers, under clearly established law, are justified in using lethal force.
Could I just ask?
Sure, of course.
Related to this line of questioning, based on the allegations in the complaint, could a reasonable jury, based on those allegations, find that the officers knew that this was a replica and was not capable of lethal force?
Based on the distance they were away, based on the lack of any allegation that the officers could see any safety measures on that weapon that would lead them to believe it was a replica, based on no allegation that they were able to see the barrel break when it was thrown, I don't believe a reasonable juror could conclude that the officers knew this was a replica.
Yeah, well, the complaint did allege that the victim said it was a pellet gun, correct?
But there's no allegation that the officers heard that from the distance that they were at. With the court's permission, I'll yield a limited time to Mr. Brooks. Thank you.
Please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, as we've said, I'm Mr. Brophy. I represent Jason Bailey and Shaver Hansen, two of the Mesa County deputies. I also represent Mesa County as it's charged in the complaint, as the court alluded to in its questioning of plaintiff. I'll address what I think is a unique issue related to Mesa County, and that is, was the county properly named in this case as a proper party in this case? I think the answer to that question is no. As the court previously pointed out, we had a state statute in Colorado that requires the Board of County Commissioners to be the named entity if you're going to sue the County of Mesa. We also have a case, in fact, one of Judge Matheson, you were on the panel for, that points out that in Colorado, under our Constitution, the Sheriff's Department is a separate legal entity from the Board of County Commissioners. We raised this in our motion under the Monell discussion because I think it goes to the heart of the problem with the pleadings that plaintiff had on their Monell claim, and that is that they haven't identified a policy and they haven't provided enough facts or any facts really to indicate that any policymaker, whether it be Mesa County or the sheriff, had sufficient notice of a training deficiency such that failure to implement training or failure to change their training constituted deliberate indifference with a likelihood of a constitutional violation resulting.
We're going to be a little flexible here on time, and what I want to ask you is, this argument about Mesa County not being the appropriate party to sue, you're raising that here now for the first time, right?
No, it's not correct.
On appeal?
I believe we raised it in the district court, and to the extent we are raising it as a jurisdictional question.
Is it a jurisdictional question for us? It may be a jurisdictional question under state law, but the whole question of who is a proper party to be sued, if you forfeited that, if you did not allege that, in the appropriate context in the district court. I don't know what, that doesn't deprive us of Article III jurisdiction, does it?
I don't necessarily know that it deprives me of Article III jurisdiction. I think it goes more to the point of why Judge Gallagher was correct in denying him an all liability, because even if we set aside that issue, there's still not enough, as Judge Gallagher found, to find that there's a policy or practice here, or a lack of policy or practice here, that establishes a mental liability. Accordingly, the motion to dismiss was correct. I raise it here simply because it's an issue that has come up, and an issue that highlights exactly that point, and that is we're not even clear which policymakers we should be considering, simply because the plaintiff hasn't brought in the proper parties to the suit. I see my time has expired. On the issues that you were discussing, Your Honor, if I may have just a minute or so to comment on the things that Mr. Zipporin was discussing.
You got 1 minute. Go.
Thank you. Your Honor, I think the key phrase that needs to be taken into consideration here, and it comes from City of Rifle, it comes from this court's jurisprudence, is the totality of the circumstances here. We need to look at everything that had happened here. From the moment that Mr. O'Leary pointed a threat with a knife and pointed the gun at civilians on a basketball court, through the police perimeter, through all of his actions in non-compliance with the police orders, with the gun. We talked about the muzzle coming off. It's unclear what that action means. Does it mean perhaps that orange tip? Are they using that as the phrase muzzle? Are they talking about the actual barrel of the gun as separate from the muzzle of the gun? There are questions here that are not clearly pled in the facts.
Well, they may be questions, but the point is we're supposed to be construing these well-pleaded facts, and even if they raise some ambiguity, that ambiguity is construed in favor of the plaintiff, right?
And that's fine, but that's when we come back to the totality of the circumstances. We have to look at, is this simply a case where a person walked out and the barrel fell off of his gun and then he got shot by police? That is absolutely not. We are the farthest from that. Is it like Allen and Ceballos, where those cases happened within 60 or 90 seconds with actions by the police that escalated these events? That is absolutely not
happening. I think that's true, that it wasn't this condensed period of time, but the question on totality of the circumstances, isn't our law to the effect that, except for this sort of notion of escalation of activity, that the question of lethal force and the reasonableness of it is judged in that moment in time,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
And if you judge in that moment of time, you have an individual who, by the plaintiff's admission, approached for a fourth time, a weapon on the ground, touched it, picked it up. And he made a strong point, but he didn't point it at anybody. The jurisprudence of this court and others in the Fifth Circuit used the glints of steel argument. The jurisprudence of the courts is not that the officers have to wait until the gun is pointed at them or hear the sound of the shot or anything like that to react and protect themselves and their fellow officers. If a reasonable officer under the circumstances believes that that is imminent, is going to happen, then that is justification for the use of deadly force.
We're getting on that minute. Do you agree with your colleague that if he had walked out of that house the first time with the gun against his chest, they could have shot him?
I think, to the extent I agree, there are circumstances where that would be a reasonable use of deadly force under the circumstances, and it would depend on the totality of the circumstances surrounding that event. What I will say is if the court wants to hold that a person walking out of his house with a gun in the face of law enforcement and not complying with their orders cannot, under any circumstances, be the subject of deadly force, it would need to say that, because we don't have case law that says that. And if that's where we want to go, we're back to the qualified immunity question, because where is the case that says, under no circumstances, if a man walks out of his house with a gun across his chest, can you use deadly force?
You heard my quote initially, and the quote was focused on the question of whether there was a reasonable perception of threat to himself,
right,
or to the public. And if I come out of that house with a gun against my chest, and there are officers there who have their guns, mm-hmm, and in that moment in time, I'm not pointing the gun at anybody, the question becomes whether it's reasonable to use lethal force to kill that person right then and there.
If an officer in the presence sees, for example, children surrounding this person.
That's not what we have here.
But that's the problem with the hypothetical, is that if we simply say in a vacuum, if this person is not surrounded by other people, is not in this in a neighborhood.
And what you agree with me on is what we're judging is that moment in time.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, in my hypothetical, the moment in time is him walking out of that house. All other things can be the same as they were in this case. And the question is, could they shoot him and kill him? And that's my question to you, because really what we're talking about is, was there a threat to them then? And no, they were a distance from him. They had their guns. They were able to respond to what he did. Was a reasonable officer able to kill him right then?
Well, let's talk about two things you brought up. The first time he walks out of the house, if a reasonable officer thought that that gun was making a motion towards a fellow officer and he shot
That's him, not what I said, right?
Well, but
I said the gun was against his chest. It wasn't pointing at anybody.
Well, but at that moment, if that gun moves, if the gun doesn't move and there's absolutely nothing whatsoever, he's frozen solid, he's got one hand in the air, he's got a gun against his chest, he's a substantial distance, 500 yards away from the officers, then no. Probably not an opportunity for a reasonable officer to say that there was a risk of threat. Now go back to the rest of your hypothetical, which is all other factors being the same. He had kicked that gun closer and closer and closer and closer to these officers. And on that fourth time, he was as close as he was going to get to those officers, and he went down and he picked up that gun. He wasn't holding it against his chest. He wasn't not moving. He was not complying with the orders. At that time, is it reasonable for those officers to believe there was a threat, even though if we argue, as you've argued, that he wasn't pointing it directly at any one of the officers, was it reasonable for those officers to believe that was a threat? Yes. That is why our jurisprudence has held, is that under those circumstances, if we go all the way...
Okay, we'll go full stop. I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
As I said, your time was up, but no, I'm sorry, but let's just go with 2 minutes here and let's... Tell us what you have to say.
Your Honors, very briefly, I agree with counsel that we need to look at the totality of the circumstances. Here we have an individual who is suffering from a mental health condition that's known to the officers in this area. He stresses that by saying that he is having suicidal ideations. This is an individual who tries to comply with demands, throwing his gun at the officers, upon which that airsoft replica then breaks. Along with the statement that it's just a pellet gun, it is unreasonable for the officers to use deadly force and shoot this individual 16 times until he was dead. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Appreciate the arguments.